This is Paul Morledge of the UW Oral History Project. It's Wednesday, May 6, 1998, and I'm going to be interviewing Professor Peter Munkmeyer of the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department. And right now we are in his living room in Shorewood Hills, and we're going to begin by discussing Professor Munkmeyer, Professor Munkmeyer's childhood and early education. Could you briefly describe your childhood and early years of schooling?
Yes, I'd be pleased to. I was born in Berlin, Germany, on June 10th in 1930. My father was a teacher in a public school, high school. My mother was a freelance writer, and both of them had PhDs. To be precise, my mother received her PhD shortly after I was born. I had certainly a happy and rather uneventful childhood for the first 6 years of my life. That included a less than a year of private school in Berlin. And I have fond recollections of those times, travels to other parts of Europe for summer vacation and the like. I do recall, or at least I believe I recall, and I'm never too sure when I think about things that occurred at that time, standing on a balcony and watching a parade in which Adolf Hitler came by in a car. It was my one and only view of him, and needless to say, I had no clear understanding of what that all meant. In early 1937, when I was still 6 years old, I was sent to my paternal grandparents in Hanover, Germany, while my parents prepared to leave the country. Because my mother's side of the family was Jewish, although my mother was a baptized Christian. I should add that the decision to leave in 1937 was probably made by my grandfather, who had already left, my maternal grandfather, who, with his wife, my grandmother, had left Berlin and moved to Prague earlier in the 30s. In fact, I remember visiting there. I vaguely remember visiting there as a child in Prague, largely because my uncle, my mother's brother, was a prominent communist. And my grandfather began to sense that being related to someone as infamous as my uncle, whose name incidentally is Heinz Neumann, anyone who is related to someone like Heinz Neumann, was probably not perfectly safe, given the turmoil that occurred in the early 30s in Germany. Fighting in Berlin between communists and Nazis and the like made it all an unsafe place. And so my grandfather persuaded my father and mother that it was time to leave. My parents, therefore, made those preparations and felt that I shouldn't be around in that time, largely because it was unclear what I might say to the wrong person at the wrong time. Subsequently, my mother picked me up in Hanover, Germany, where, as I said, I was staying with my grandparents, my paternal grandparents, and took me to Brussels and then to Paris, where we met my father. My father had not applied for a permission to leave the country. As a teacher, he really was considered to be essential, in an essential occupation at that time. But he was able to obtain a visitor's visa to take a vacation in Switzerland. And apparently the authorities didn't understand or grasp the significance of that request, but needless to say, he never returned. He then went from Switzerland to Paris, and I remember going by night train to Le Havre, and then on the SS Manhattan via Southampton to New York City. My parents and I took up residence on West 91st Street. I may be off by a block there, but anyhow, on the west side of New York, in a brownstone. And my father was hired by Columbia Grammar Private School to teach French while I was enrolled as a pupil there. Because he had never taught French, and I might add, he was urged simply to stay one lesson ahead of the class, and because my tuition ate up most of his salary, this arrangement didn't last very long. We then left Midtown and moved uptown to an apartment house just north of 200th Street. 200th Street in New York is also called Dyckman Street. And I entered public school 52, and then subsequently junior high school 52. I have fond memories of that time too. It was a good time in my life. I certainly did not have the feelings of dislocation that my parents had, being forced to move to another country and having to start their lives all over again. I might add that my dad was in his upper 50s, substantially older than my mother, and consequently having put in almost the better part of a career as a teacher, he now had to develop a new career in order to make a living in New York City. In 1944, I took an entrance exam for Brooklyn Technical High School. I took that exam largely because my friends were going to take the exam, and it involved taking a day off from school. We had to take the subway 45 minutes to Brooklyn, 45 back, and frankly, it seemed like a lark to me, so I decided to sign up too, even though I had no particular thought about going to Brooklyn Technical High School. Well, when I got there, we sat in the auditorium to take the examination. And in those days, it was customary to intimidate young people in school a little bit, just to show them who was boss. And that was done in the following way at Brooklyn Tech. We were told to look at the person in front of us, the person behind us, the person on either side of us, and the person on the four diagonals. In other words, we were supposed to look at eight people. Adding ourselves, that meant nine people. We were told that of the nine, only one of them was going to be admitted, and all the others would fail the examination. Well, again, I wasn't too concerned because I wasn't planning to go there anyhow. But I was admitted, and I did spend 4 years in the college preparatory program at Brooklyn Technical High School. And I found an interest in mathematics, physics, and chemistry. And I guess one might say that was what got me started on a career in engineering.
Okay. Can you say a little bit more about the nature of Brooklyn Technical High School?
Yes, well, Brooklyn Tech was one of several schools in the New York City area. Others were Bronx High School of Science, and Peter Stuyvesant was another one. That these were schools that you could only enter through an entrance examination. Most pupils in New York City would go to their regional high school, which in my case would have been George Washington High School, which is located not too far from my home at that time. Brooklyn Technical High School was the premier engineering preparatory school in the New York City area. Bronx High School of Science focused more on science. So those of us who entered the school invariably had fairly high averages and presumably had some motivation at least to work in, to take classes in technical content. There was a college preparatory program, which I took, but there were also more vocationally oriented programs for students who were not planning to go to college. There were about 6,000 students. It was an enormous building in Brooklyn. It was all male at the time I was there. And parenthetically, women were added, perhaps girls would be more appropriate to say, and were admitted sometime subsequently. I don't really know which year, but I did go back to Brooklyn Tech after becoming a faculty member at Wisconsin to do some minority recruiting for the Engineering Minorities Program, about which I'll say a few words later on. I found that not only were there a lot of women, there were a lot of black women at Brooklyn Tech. In fact, white students were undoubtedly in the minority, and in fact I had a discussion with a young student who was of Italian background, who wanted to know if Wisconsin had any minority funding for someone with his background. And he certainly was a minority in his school. Well, needless to say, that wasn't the case. But I was very interested in that transition to a very different kind of a student enrollment. But apparently it still maintains a high level of academic achievement.
Okay, did any family members and or teachers influence the direction of your studies?
Well, let me turn that around and talk about the teachers first, because I don't really recall any specifics in that case. I had one teacher in elementary school named Mrs. Roseman, who I valued greatly. I had her for three semesters. The school system in New York was broken down into semesters. I would, in the fall, be, let's say, in class 3A, and then in spring in 3B. I had her for three semesters, and she made quite an impression on me. Among other things, when I misbehaved in the Museum of Natural History, she smacked me across the face. I still loved her, despite the fact that she did something she would never be allowed to do today. I had other teachers at Brooklyn Tech who collectively, I guess, impressed me with their knowledge. I can't single people out. There were individual instances. There were math teachers who I thought were very impressive in their ability to not only teach math, but in terms of how to interpret it in interesting and intriguing ways. And that probably had some impact on my subsequent interest in math and applied math as an engineer. And there were others who simply impressed me with their knowledge. And in many ways, I think that's a form of stimulation that perhaps can't be explicitly described in terms of some incident that occurred, but nevertheless was important to me. To go back to the family members, of course, when your parents are both highly educated with PhDs and having spent many years at universities, that climate of education pervades the home. My dad, I can still see him sitting in his chair reading, something he did every evening, smoking his pipe and reading interesting books and occasionally talking to me about some of the things he was reading. He had been a geography teacher and a history teacher, and so those were fields that he was particularly interested in. He had an enormously an enormous talent for describing geographic locations around the globe, to which he had never been, but which he had read so much about that he could literally draw you a picture of what these places were like. And that certainly rubbed off on me.
Did you have any early career aspirations?
Well, as I explained before, in some senses, going to Brooklyn Tech was an accident, but maybe it was an accident that was meant to happen. Once I got there, it became very clear to me that this was the right place for me. And my interest in the physical sciences was perhaps awakened or developed a little bit more fully than it was in the elementary school. Certainly a lot was developed to a much better extent in high school, but it also became clear to me that these were things that I really wanted to do and that I was interested in.
Now we're going to discuss, talk about Professor Monkmeyer's employment in higher education. Why did you decide to enroll at Cornell University?
Well, I was, of course, not too well acquainted with any of the universities to which I applied, but it seemed logical, and after talking to my parents, that I should apply to some universities not too far from New York City, but far enough to get me out of the home for a while. And Cornell, Syracuse, and RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, were the three I selected. I applied for mechanical engineering at RPI, and probably also at Syracuse, although I'm not entirely certain. I didn't really have a clear idea of what civil engineering was, and mechanical engineering was certainly something that I felt I had a better handle on. And I also, I'll come back to Cornell in a moment, and I also applied to City University, which was at that time called City College of New York, CCNY, also for engineering. That was, you might say, the fourth choice. If I were not to be admitted to the other institutions, then I could always come back to City University, where I was very likely to be admitted. The application to Cornell was made in agriculture, and that was done quite consciously because my parents really didn't feel that they could afford the tuition for the other institutions, the other upstate institutions. City University was tuition free. So I applied to Cornell in agriculture with the intent of taking agricultural engineering. Now, that may seem as a compromise between a general engineering program as opposed to an engineering program that had a very heavy dose of agriculture in it. But I should also add that in the years prior to entering college, in those years, I think it was about 5 summers, I had worked on farms, various farms in Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, and in Michigan. When I was very young and began that, I really simply lived on the farm and helped out and got a little pocket change. But that grew to full-fledged jobs in the last years when I was 15, 16, and 17. And those were the years when I worked for a salary on farms in those 3 states. That was, it was Connecticut, Michigan, and then New York, in that order. Those positions, of course, led to my interest in agriculture, and I thought that by taking agricultural engineering, I would, in some senses, have the best of both worlds. So the decision to go to Cornell was driven in part by financial considerations, but also because I thought here was an interesting opportunity to bring together 2 things that I'd been exposed to, agriculture and engineering. So that probably answers the question of why I chose this course of study. As to when I chose it, I'm not entirely sure, but probably in the previous year. I did actually graduate from high school at mid-year. That was something that occurred because I skipped a grade when I was younger. So I graduated in January, and I had some time to think about these things because Cornell, like most universities, wasn't going to admit me until the fall. So I had a job for a spring, in the spring, prior to going to work on a farm in the summer and then enter Cornell in the fall.
What courses, fellow students and/or instructors influence you the most in your undergraduate years at Cornell?
Well, the courses that intrigued me the most were ones which I took when I was it was the spring of 51. I'd been there for a few years and taken the usual basic courses in chemistry and math and physics, which ag engineers took, and of course a lot of agricultural courses. But what I guess really caught my interest was the course in fluid mechanics, which I took in the civil engineering department, and a course in soil and water management, which I took in agricultural engineering. And I should add that my advisor, Professor Harold Gray, his special area was soil and water management. I mean, he taught that particular course, and so he was really grooming me, in a sense, for this particular semester and subsequent semesters when I took more advanced topics in the soil and water area of agricultural engineering. So that pretty well, I think, explains who the instructor was that influenced me. Of course, I was also influenced to a lesser extent by other faculty, but somewhat like my experience at Brooklyn Tech, I was really quite impressed by the various faculty members and had good relations with them. Professor Lanny Boyd was a professor of farm structures, who incidentally subsequently became the department chair at Minnesota in agricultural engineering. Professor O.C. French was the department chairman. He was a very dignified gentleman, and while I didn't have a lot of contact with him, I did see him quite regularly because I got a job in the department office running a mimeograph machine, and so since that machine was right outside his office, I would see him coming and going, and he was always friendly and also made a very strong impression on me. So I was really surrounded by some really good role models, aside, of course, from the other teachers and professors I had in courses that I took outside the College of Agriculture, particularly in math, chemistry, and physics, where we had some people who really could put on a good show and at the same time really teach us the material. So those were, I would say, the people who influenced me most. Students, I had some friends. I wouldn't say that they had a strong influence on my undergraduate program. But I should add that at the same time, I had developed a contact with a group of graduate students and ex-GIs, which for a freshman like me was a pretty heady company to be in, who were basically the students in the Episcopal Church on the campus of Cornell. And so, having been an Episcopalian myself prior to that, I was drawn into that, and particularly into that group, and of course also by the chaplain, who happened to have arrived on campus not very long before I did. So I was influenced, I suppose, in a religious and moral and ethical direction by the Episcopal chaplain and some of these older students with whom I spent quite a bit of time outside of my agricultural engineering program.
Okay, and you remained at Cornell to pursue your master's degree in hydraulics.
Yes, I should add that while I did, in a sense, remain, there was an interval of 2 years when I went into the military service. Right after I graduated, the Korean War had become a reality in our lives, and I had decided to, let me put it this way, to obtain a job in 1952, in the summer of 1952, was a difficult thing if you had not served in the military, because people were being drafted. And consequently, most employers weren't particularly interested in hiring somebody who had not fulfilled some kind of a military commitment. Now, on the other hand, I wasn't prepared to sit around and wait to be drafted, because I really wanted to keep things moving, and I didn't want to spend time in some trivial job waiting to be drafted. So after some consultation with some other people, I decided to enlist in the Army. And that basically forced the issue, and I enlisted in July, as I recall, July of 1952, and served first of all for a little over a year in the Army Corps of Engineers after basic training at Fort Dix in New Jersey. I held a position as a surveyor. My MOS was actually as a draftsman, but I was primarily employed as a surveyor on a surveying team that worked in out of the post engineer's office in at Fort Dix. And again, that was pretty easy duty. Weekends I could go home. It wasn't that far from New York City, so it was not a particularly trying time. But then with just about 10 months left of service, I received orders to go overseas. Now, I should add that it was customary not to send someone overseas if they had less than 9 months left. So I was right on the edge, and I really was not anticipating being sent overseas, but I thought I'd serve out my last 9 months at Fort Dix. My overseas assignment was to Germany. And in Germany, when I arrived there, I was sent to Hanau. Hanau is a city a short distance east of Frankfurt. In Hanau, I was assigned to a machine records division. It's one of the first computer focused groups in the army. The Army had a school somewhere in the German Alps where people were taught to use the earliest computers. So this was in 1952. And when I got there to Hanau, I was one of the few people in the division who did not have computer background. I was then expected to do mainly drafting for the publications that were put out, primarily putting title pages and things like that onto the publications. This was all an operation that was located in a depot. It was an ordnance depot that the Army had taken over from the German Army after the war. I stayed there until I was sent home shortly before my time was up. But an interesting part of the last couple of months at this post was that the machine records division was moved to France. In part, the feeling was that the division was a little bit too close to the the Iron Curtain, that is the border between East and West Germany, and it was moved to France. But since I was a short timer, I was left behind, and among other duties that I had to guard a locomotive. Every few days, as this base was being dismantled, trains would leave with ordnance parts. I don't know where they went, whether they went to France or whether stuff was junked. My job was to unlock the gate, hop on the locomotive with the engineer, and the train would then leave the depot. I'd go back and lock the gate. And then I'd accompany the train to the nearest train station, and then I would be picked up by a Jeep and brought back. This was a very interesting experience because since I still spoke fluent German, I had very interesting conversations with my friends, my newfound friends who were running the locomotive. I also packed a pistol, but no one ever told me why I was packing the pistol, and I fortunately never found it necessary to take it out of the holster. Then I was sent back to the States was released and found myself in that position, which is not so unusual among young people. What do I do next? I wasn't really too sure that I wanted to pursue agricultural engineering, and I really wasn't too sure what else I might do. I spent
how old were you at this point?
I must have been 24.
Okay.
This was 1954, the summer of 1954, and I went on vacation with my parents, and I remember that we basically drove each other crazy over the issue of what was I going to do next. Well, I decided to go back to Cornell and talk to the faculty. And I talked to faculty in agricultural engineering, and I talked to faculty in civil engineering, where I had, after all, taken at least one interesting course. And I was fortunate enough to find Professor Andre Jorissen, who was the chairman of the hydraulics department, which was a department in the School of Civil Engineering. And he suggested that I, to help me make a decision about what to do, I should rank my courses in the order of the grades I had. Well, what developed out of that should have been obvious to me in the first place, but for some reason or other I overlooked it, and that was that all the engineering courses surfaced at the top and all the agriculture courses were at the bottom of the list. So that pretty well told me in what direction to go. And he said that he would accept me if I could persuade the, as for a master's degree, if I could persuade the director of the School of Civil Engineering. This was Professor Nephi Christensen. Well, I had a meeting with Professor Christensen, and he was very friendly and told me that since I didn't have an undergraduate degree in civil engineering, it would take me about 2 years of additional work to get the bachelor's degree. As I recall, in those days, they had a 5-year bachelor's degree program. So I got some credit for the things I did, and he expected that it would take me 2 more years. And then, as I was about to say something that really interested me, he went on to say that he could also put together for me a master's program that would take 2 years. Masters usually took 1 year at that time, and he said I really should take an extra year and pick up some courses. Now, he never told me what courses to pick up, he just said I should spend two years. Well, the only problem I had at this point was to come up with a rational explanation for why I preferred the master's over the bachelor's, other than that it was a more advanced degree. But in some way or other, I persuaded him very easily that I preferred the master's, and he said, fine. And so I enrolled for a master's degree in hydraulics in the School of Civil Engineering. And my professor, my major professor, was Professor Jorissen. I was given a very interesting master's thesis topic, which Professor Jorissen had already laid the groundwork for before I came, and it involved the testing of a quadrant-edged orifice. Well, most orifice plates, an orifice plate is simply a plate with a hole in it. You install it in a pipe, and it constricts the flow through the pipe, and by measuring the pressure on the upstream and downstream side and measuring the difference, one can correlate that to the flow rate and determine how much liquid is passing through the pipe and, of course, through the orifice. Those orifice plates are generally sharp-edged, but this quadrant-edged was a new idea. It was an orifice plate that had some advantages for measurement purposes, particularly at relatively low flows. I don't think I should go into all the details, but suffice it to say that, like most master students or graduate students, I remember spending many late hours working early into the morning with my equipment being challenged by the fact that I was running oil rather than water, and oil, as I learned, can create much more of a mess when you spill it than water does. And so I learned a good many things, and I produced my master's thesis. And that completed my work in 1956. I was pretty busy, but not so busy that I didn't meet my wife, my future wife. And we were married at the end of that summer in 1956, very shortly after I completed my master's final oral examination. From there, I went to Karlsruhe, Germany on a Fulbright grant. I had applied for the grant earlier in the year, in fact, before I met my wife, and I remember having to persuade the Fulbright people to come up with a little extra money for her, because that was customary when you had a spouse along. We left only a few days after our wedding in September for Germany, and I then spent a year in Germany at the Karlsruhe, at that time it was called the Technische Hochschule, which literally translated would mean technical high school, but high schools were really college-level institutes, and so this was the Karlsruhe Technical Institute, would be a better translation into English. I spent some time at Karlsruhe in the classroom. I was interested in listening to lectures in German. My German was coming back to me. I had an opportunity to develop my technical vocabulary, words that I was unfamiliar with. I'd come to the conclusion that my German was really sort of a household German, the type of German that a child would learn while growing up. But since I had never taken formal lessons in German, I then made it my business to pick up on things that I was unfamiliar with while listening to lectures there and while talking to students and faculty in Karlsruhe. My research, this was really pretty much of an instructional grant from Fulbright, it was a student grant, but I did have some opportunity to work with one of the German assistants. Graduate students were usually called assistants. They don't seem to use the term quite comparable to graduate student. They were assistants, and they all had their diploma, which is roughly equivalent to a bachelor's degree. And in particular, I was assigned and found it very interesting to work with a young man named Walter Wunderlich. Walter was working on some overflow structures that were models in the laboratory of structures to be built on some of the rivers not too far from Karlsruhe. These rivers are very small rivers, and by our standards would probably be more comparable to creeks or streams, but nevertheless, there were erosion problems and things that needed to be dealt with, and these structures were designed to deal with those problems. So Walter Wunderlich certainly had an impact on me because he was a really talented modeler who worked very effectively in the laboratory, and I learned a few things from him about laboratory instrumentation and model construction. Walter and I have tried to remain in touch. He subsequently came to the States and worked for the TVA and is currently semi-retired but still doing consulting in Tennessee. As far as instructors were concerned, the German professors who taught these courses were pretty remote from students like me. I would only see them in the classroom and on some special occasion, otherwise they were not very accessible. The situation in Germany was rather interesting at that time, particularly at Karlsruhe, because there were two chairs that were seemingly covering the same material in hydraulics, and I was assigned to one of those without really knowing much about the difference. The professors that held these two chairs divided up the coursework, so there was no overlap in that regard. But as far as the research was concerned, they were doing much the same thing. It may be interesting historically to try to understand why this situation had developed. After the war, Professor Wittmann, who had been the one and only professor of hydraulics at Karlsruhe, and who was, for one reason or another, had become a member of the Nazi Party, which was not uncommon among faculty at universities. It was, I guess, considered to be the smart thing to do if you were going to retain any sort of authority as a faculty member, or even whether you even retain your chair as a faculty member at a university. And so after the war, when the denazification period set in, Professor Wittmann was dismissed, and his assistant, Professor Buss, took over the position. Professor Buss then remained in charge of the laboratory, which was basically in the basement of the civil engineering building. And there came another period, which one might describe as the denazification period, when it became clear that a number of these people, not all of them certainly, but a number of these people, had been members of the party in name only. They really had not committed any atrocities or done anything other than to sign up, pick up a card, and then go about their business. And it was decided that Professor Wittmann was one of these people. He also seemed to have a lot of friends in high places, so it wouldn't surprise me that that helped him to regain his chair. And so Professor Wittmann not only received a chair, a new chair, but they didn't want to displace Professor Buss, so the decision was made that Professor Wittmann should get a brand new laboratory. And when I arrived, I must say that I was a little bit disappointed to be assigned to Professor Buss, because he was in the basement of the civil engineering building, and Professor Wittmann had a wonderful new facility. But I still enjoyed my lectures and my time with the graduate students at that time, and of course it was also my first year of married life, and my wife and I had a good time in Germany. Should add that my wife had spent a year as a house mother in Germany only a year or two before we went to Karlsruhe, and so her German language abilities were excellent, and both of us had no difficulty in getting along and doing the daily activities that one must do when one lives in a foreign country.
Hey, when you arrived back in the States, you enrolled at your alma mater for your PhD. Why did you choose to remain at Cornell for your doctoral work?
Well, I really never intended to leave Cornell. The chance to obtain a Fulbright grant to Germany, something which my professor Jorissen encouraged. I should add, Professor Jorissen was a Belgian by birth, spoke with a very decided French accent. So he was a European at heart, and he certainly encouraged me to go to Germany when that opportunity came along. But it was certainly my intention to go back, and to go back and to work for my PhD with Professor Jorissen. And so I returned to Cornell, and I guess there's one other thing that should be added to all of this. When I began my master's studies and they made the decision to go to Cornell, I did look at some other universities as a possibility. And the one that comes to mind was Cooper Union, a really well-known institution in New York City that particularly specialized in night school. And when I applied to Cooper Union, they gave me virtually no credit for my work at Cornell in the agricultural engineering department, even though many of the courses were taken in the College of Engineering. That discouraged me, of course, from going to other universities. Cornell was willing to give me some credit for the ag engineering work because they could evaluate it better than other institutions could. So that really was the reason why I remained at Cornell. I was certainly aware of the fact that one should go to a different institution for an advanced degree, if at all possible. But since I was switching from one field to another, it became quite clear that Cornell was the right place for me to go.
What was your course of doctoral study, and what did your dissertation research focus on at Cornell?
Well, my course of study was really a continuation of some of the work that I had begun in the master's degree, at least as far as coursework was concerned. I continued to take advanced courses in my major field, which was still hydraulics. I was obliged to take two minor fields. One of them was soil mechanics, so I took a number of courses in soil mechanics. And the other field was aerodynamics, and so I, needless to say, took a number of courses in aerodynamics. And that really broadened my understanding of related areas, all of them having to do with fluid flow, fluid mechanics, all being applications or incorporating applications of fluid mechanics. Before I get to the dissertation research, I should simply explain that initially, like many graduate students, I focused on coursework, and so I did not select a research topic immediately. I held teaching positions, so I was kept busy as a teaching assistant throughout this time. Then Professor Jorissen died, and that created a problem for me. Obviously, I needed a new major professor. Now, I had not gotten deeply into research, so that part of the problem was certainly not a factor for me. But as it turned out, the hydraulics department, which had one time had four faculty members, was suddenly reduced to one because two of the other faculty members left for other positions. And the remaining person in the department, Professor Marvin Bogema, had never been on good terms with Jorison and was not particularly excited to accept one of Jorison's graduate students as a graduate student of his. So I would say that I was decidedly unwelcome. And my first clash with Professor Bogema occurred when I decided to spend the weekend with friends about a mile out of town, and there was a blizzard, and I was unable to show up for my teaching duties on the first day of the semester. My phone call didn't help very much. Professor Bogema told me it was my business not to go out of town, even though it was only a mile out of town. Well, in due time, Bogema and I, being, since he was the only faculty member in the group for quite a while, there was a long period of interviewing of candidates, and since I had, you might say, graduated to the status of senior graduate student, I received more and more responsibility, and he and I drew closer and closer together. And so the story has a happy ending. I had a first-rate relationship with Bogema in my last year or two. Unfortunately, Bogema also died. So I, you might say, I had two of my major professors died while I was on campus.
You killed them.
Some people have suggested that I had a bad influence on the two faculty members. But before Bogema died, I should add that he believed strongly that PhD students should come up with their own research topic. I got no guidance, I received no guidance from him at all on a research topic. But at that time, I became acquainted with a professor in electrical engineering who was interested in radio waves and radio transmissions through the atmosphere. And while that seemed pretty far away from anything that I was doing in with water in the hydraulics group, there was a fluid mechanic problem, namely the impact of airflow over mountains, which would cause wave actions in the atmosphere that would have an impact, or might have an impact, on these radio waves. So, under the direction of my thesis advisor, not my major professor, but my thesis advisor, Professor Ralph Bolgiano in electrical engineering, I began a project that was quite theoretical in nature, to develop formulations of various kinds of wave characteristics in the atmosphere generated by the topography in the area of interest. So I worked on this project, on this thesis. And as I say, and it was at about that time that, as I got well into it, that Bogema died. And finally, the director of the school, Professor Christensen, who I mentioned before, agreed to become my major professor, mainly to oversee the completion of my work. I didn't really finish my thesis until 1962, even though I began employment at Wisconsin in 1961. At that time, it was certainly possible to obtain a position as an assistant professor on a tenure track without having a PhD. And if you were well on your way toward having a PhD, that was considered satisfactory. Needless to say, you were expected to get the PhD in short order, but that's certainly a different policy from one we adopted not too long after I came, when it was decided that if one didn't have a PhD, one couldn't really begin as an assistant professor, but it would have to begin their studies, employment as an instructor or in some other capacity prior to finishing a PhD. Of course, in recent years, we haven't hired anybody who didn't, who had not completed their PhD. But as I say, back in 1961, well, those policies were a little bit different. Well, let me come back now to the and complete my comments about Cornell University. I think I've said what I need to say about the dissertation and the people who influenced my work. I would say all of the faculty I've mentioned had, again, a positive influence, as did many other faculty members with whom I had occasional contact. Now, there is also the question of instruction and teaching. I held a position as a teaching assistant initially, and then, having gained some experience, I subsequently became an instructor. The difference was largely in the level of responsibility, but it was all very clearly in the teaching area. My initial teaching focused on laboratory, as a laboratory assistant in undergraduate fluid mechanics and fluid mechanics course. I then was put in charge of a course on fluid mechanics that was taught exclusively to electrical engineers. In those days, electrical engineers were expected to have at least one semester in this area, and a required semester, and so I was given that responsibility. And I had complete responsibility for the course. I was not assisting a faculty member. And that was, for me, quite an interesting experience. The electrical engineering students were unusually bright, and we had a really good relationship with them. To demand that I provide a demonstration of a principle that I had described on the blackboard. Now, that demand, it wasn't clear to me why they wanted this, and there was a lot of giggling going on, so I sensed that something was afoot. But they wanted to see some flow process demonstrated. Now, we had a flume in the classroom, a little portable flume, and water was in there, and you could turn this flume on, and it would circulate water, and you could demonstrate various things. So I finally decided that I could meet this demand, and I went over to the flume, and just as I was about to turn on the switch, I realized that they had put some goldfish into the flume. And of course, at this point, there was a great deal of laughter, and I decided that if they were having that much fun in my class that they could afford to put goldfish into the flume just to have a laugh, I thought that was a pretty good sign. Anyhow, I had a good relationship with these students, and they and some others actually nominated me for a membership in an honorary society. So it was a time where I felt that my teaching was, at least in some sense, successful. I suppose that had some impact on my interest and desire to continue to be a teacher and instructor. That one other thing that occurred at that time, I was asked to teach a course that I had never taken before. And as a graduate student with limited teaching experience, that was a challenge that I really wanted to meet. It was a course that was being phased out, and there were 5 students left who had to take it to complete their curriculum requirements. So I had a small class of 5 students, and the course was on water supply. It was a course that dealt with things that I was familiar with, but also dealt with chemical questions and other issues having to do with the supply of water in municipalities. So I was given some notes by the professor who had taught it previously, and really had a very exciting time teaching a course that with new material. Needless to say, it took a lot more of my time, but it was a worthwhile experience.
Okay, how did you find your way to Wisconsin before you actually obtained your PhD?
Well, my wife and I had gone to a conference in Colorado. It was, I was still a graduate student. It was probably in about 19, let me think this through now. It was probably in 1959 or 60 in the summer that my wife and I decided to attend a conference sponsored by the American Society of Civil Engineers Hydraulics Division. The conference was held at Fort Collins, Colorado State, and it meant that we would have to drive across the country to get there. And of course that in itself was an interesting experience. Because I had never been west of Michigan before. Come to think of it, I guess I had been to Kansas, but I'd never been that far west, and certainly not to the Rocky Mountains. And so we drove to the conference. Now, at the conference, I met 2 people, certainly quite by coincidence, both of whom were faculty at the University of Wisconsin. One of them was Professor Arno T. Lenz, who was then the department chairman of civil engineering at Wisconsin. And the other one was Professor Jim Villamont, who was the head of the hydraulics group at Wisconsin in civil and environmental engineering. Now, I met them, and of course, both of them encouraged me to complete my PhD work and keep in touch. But that was probably just about enough for me to have an opening, you might say, in the future. We went back to Cornell. I continued my work. And as I said before, with only 1 faculty member in hydraulics at Cornell, and therefore a number of vacancies, the faculty was in the process of interviewing candidates for positions. Now, it was difficult to interview candidates, largely because there was not a hydraulics group, but only 1 senior professor. And as I said, not too long after that, he died. So consequently, the interview process was a lengthy one, with numerous candidates coming. And in fact, I remember one candidate telling me that there was a lot of concern by candidates that Cornell was not making a decision about this problem, and that this certainly didn't make the position look any more attractive. Well, my role in all of this was as the senior graduate student in the group. I was given numerous assignments, like making housing arrangements and luncheon reservations and basically preparing agendas and things like this
for the applicants
to come through. And invariably, I was invited, even though I was a graduate student, I was invited sometimes to lunch, to meet these prospective candidates. And I got to know them all, and I was, you might say, on the inside regarding who was a viable candidate and which one did the faculty really like, and so forth. In fact, I also learned when one of them was made an offer and accepted it, the person who has since become a good friend of mine, Professor Jim Liggett, was an assistant professor at Wisconsin, and when Liggett accepted the position at Cornell, I was one of the first to hear about it, and therefore I knew immediately that there was a vacancy at Cornell, at Wisconsin. So I got on the telephone, and I called up Professor Villamont, who, after all, I had met only a year or so earlier. And I told him that I was interested in the position, and of course he was somewhat surprised that I even knew there was a position, and I explained my situation, and his response was, how soon can you come out for an interview? And I told him something like next weekend, maybe one or two weekends hence. It was May, and coming to the end of the semester, and I told him that I could come on a Friday and stay over till Saturday. In those days, it was very, very customary for everyone to go to work on Saturday, just like one did the other 5 days of the week. And of course, classes were offered on Saturdays and so forth. Well, so arranging for Friday-Saturday was not unusual. I arrived, and I had my interview. I made a presentation on my research, which, as I said, wasn't complete, but I was able to certainly talk about what I was doing. And I met the faculty. I went down to the old hydraulics lab, which is now called the Lakeshore Lab on Lake Mendota. It's a building that is, of course, still there. And I met the other faculty in civil engineering, Professor Lenz, the department chairman, the dean, Dean Wendt, and in fact, I even met the vice president of the university, which was Professor Harrington, who subsequently became the president of the university. And so I met a lot of people, and I remember particularly talking to Harrington because Harrington's father was a very prominent hydrologist. And so when I met Harrington, I think he asked me if I knew about his father, and I happily was able to say yes. I had even read portions of the book that he had written. So I was offered the job that Saturday. I called up my wife and asked her what she thought about coming to Wisconsin. She had fortunately come to Wisconsin for a summer session, lived in Liz Waters, and knew enough about the campus to give me the green light. And so I informed Professor Villamont that I would accept the position. Now, mind you, all of this took probably no more than 2 weeks from the time that I made my phone call introducing myself or reintroducing myself to the time that I had the job, something which in today's world is totally impossible. But at that time, it was still doable. And so I went back to Cornell, continued working, arrived in Wisconsin in August or September, and was ready to begin working for my first year as an assistant professor.
Okay, one thing I still haven't, I'm not clear on, yes. What was it about Wisconsin that attracted you?
Well, yes, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that. I had received and was in touch with a number of other universities. I was in touch with California Davis. I was in touch with the University of Oklahoma, Kansas, and Notre Dame. Those are the ones that come to mind. Now, when I say in touch with, that means I've heard about openings or I was in communication with someone at those institutions. Oklahoma really didn't interest me. I just felt that that was a part of the country I knew nothing about and I wasn't really particularly interested in going. At the University of Kansas, one of the first things they asked me long before we got into any kind of negotiation, I was sent a copy of the State of Kansas Loyalty Oath and asked to sign it, something which I decided I didn't want to do. So that ended my conversation with the University of Kansas. With Notre Dame, I must confess, in those days, people had biases they don't always have today, but with the also a little nudge from my wife, the idea of going to a university that was a prominent Roman Catholic university, and I wasn't a Roman Catholic, didn't seem to make much sense to me. So I didn't pursue that. That was undoubtedly an error on my part, because I've been to Notre Dame since then, and their faculty is very well integrated, and it's a really first-rate institution, but particularly in some of the areas that I work in. But at that time, anyhow, I made a decision not to pursue that.
So wait, now you're saying you almost wish you had gone to Notre Dame?
No, I wouldn't. Oh, okay. I wouldn't go that far. Oh, okay. But I would say that I probably didn't use a very good sense in making this decision. I should have at least gone there and met the people and made some kind of decision based on that. This was just sort of a an off thing.
In a cursory way.
Yeah, sort of, yeah. It was really a bias, and not a very well-founded bias, I might add. I think we had the vision that the community was 100% Roman Catholic, and we weren't going to fit in there. I mean, after all, I had become a fairly active Episcopalian, and I would have certainly not been happy about going to a community where I wouldn't find my own church. Of course, this was all not... this was all a little bit naive, but one has to understand that I had only been west of the Hudson River a few times, so I wasn't too familiar. Well, I shouldn't say west of the Hudson River. I really was west of the Hudson River, but that's just the term you use in New York City when you're talking about the rest of the country. But I hadn't been very far west, and I really didn't know much about the Midwest.
Well.
One more institution was the University of California at Davis, and I really was in quite serious negotiations with Davis, but they informed me that they didn't have the resources to bring me out to Davis, which meant that I really couldn't see the institution. Instead, they were going to have one of their faculty members, who happened to be near Cornell, stop in and interview me at Cornell. Well, that did not make me very happy. I really wanted to see what I was getting into. And so things sort of broke down. I didn't feel that I had a sufficiently good handle on what it was like. I'd never been to California, and I really felt I needed to know more about the place before I could continue to negotiate. But it was for Wisconsin. I received this immediate invitation to come out, immediately. And of course, that one thing led to another, and I accepted the job. And I felt I was with interesting people. The laboratory was an interesting and active place. There were plenty of graduate students around, and it was a real opportunity.
What sort of reputation did Wisconsin have on the East Coast?
Well, I would say this. To be quite frank with you, I knew virtually nothing about Wisconsin when I came to Wisconsin. I certainly knew it was a northern state, and I felt like a northerner. And again, one made those distinctions much more so. I wasn't a westerner, and I wasn't a southerner. I was a northerner, and I felt Wisconsin was north. Again, somewhat naive bias that one isn't so relevant today, but it was at that time. At least it was to me. The only thing I knew about Wisconsin was that they played football on Saturday afternoons, to be quite frank. And I had met Professor Villamont and Professor Lentz, and that probably was also a deciding factor. I had met them, I had good conversations with them, they seemed to be interested in me, and I was certainly interested in them. I think that probably was as big a factor as any. But I knew absolutely nothing about Wisconsin. I'd never been here before when I came on that interview. And as far as the work that had been done in hydraulics in my field, the sorts of things that I had been doing at Cornell were not, there were not similar things going on at Wisconsin. And in fact, as I'll explain a little bit later, my teaching program at Wisconsin over the years included numerous courses that I never had had as a graduate student myself, or even had something similar as a graduate student. There were numbers of things that we developed here, not based on things at Cornell, but new course topics that had never been offered here or at Cornell in previous years. But that's, after all, a natural evolution that one perhaps can expect. But I did not come to Wisconsin because I had been doing a certain kind of research which would fit well into the program here. That was not the case. And perhaps in those days, those kinds of questions weren't asked as much as they are today. One was simply content to have someone who had a certain amount of laboratory experience and a certain amount of theoretical experience. I had probably a little bit more of the latter, and I think that the idea was that I would develop programs in theoretical fluid mechanics, but not neglect the laboratory experience. And to that extent, they were looking at my background, but I don't think they were particularly interested in the atmospheric wave theories that I had been working on, because I was going to be working with very different things here. And I did work with very different things here. That work at Cornell had only a very mild impact on one portion of my research in subsequent years, but not very much.